call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Before we get started today, we are going to carry over until Monday's meeting the Senate Bill 1530. And we will be taking up today Senate Bill 1532 and having a public hearing on SJR 202. So I think we will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 1532. Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senate Bill 1532, you have a dash 3 amendment that you had discussed previously, and we didn't have all of the paperwork, but we do have it all now. Dash 3 amendment, if you look at really the under Section 3, sub 3, 4, 5, and 6, define what would be consistent with a data transmission company, and then goes through and identifies those conditions in which that type of property would not be subject to central assessment. The property must be located in an enterprise zone. Each of those individual properties would be determined on an individual basis. It would not be a statewide exemption. And the other change from the original amendment, the dash one amendment that came out, is that the exemption from central assessment would apply for the life of the enterprise zone and not beyond it.
Okay.
You do have a measure summary of a fiscal impact statement, and I did write a very brief revenue impact statement on it. It's basically indeterminate. There could potentially be an effect on property tax liability for these types of companies that construct data centers in an enterprise zone, but given the ambiguity of the current law, given the temporary rule that was issued by the Department of Revenue, it's our feeling that there's no way to quantify what that potential would be, so we've given it an indeterminate revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. And, committee, this is a very narrow fix to solve a problem that came up after Facebook had made a decision to locate in Prineville partly on the basis of having an enterprise zone treatment. And then there was an interpretation that called that into question. So we all recognize that there is a serious need to update our central assessment statutes. This is not it. This is a very narrow fix to a specific problem pertaining to enterprise zones. So don't anybody be under the impression that we have solved central assessment, because we have not. Senator Morse, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 1532, dated 2612.
Senator Morse has moved the dash 3 amendments to amendments to Senate Bill 1532. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1532. As amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 1532 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the work that this committee's done and everybody that's participated. This, to me, it looks like the kind of fix that says Oregon has made good on its word to a particular company with respect to enterprise zones. It isn't the overall fix, and I look forward to working on that ever so exciting issue of central assessment. But I do think that this bill exemplifies what our new short session really is all about, that we can fix things that may not necessarily be statewide emergencies, but need prompt attention, and that's what this is. It is not an overall major tax reform change. But I think it is exactly in the spirit of what these kinds of sessions were put on the books by voters to do in trying to solve these kinds of problems.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Hess. Any other discussion? Okay. Any objection? Okay, so ordered. I will carry this bill. Now we will open a public hearing on SJR 202. Paul.
Madam Chair, SJR 202, we have a packet of material for you in your packet, and we have three pieces. One is labeled the Solution for Oregon Sustainable and Stable Revenue and Spending. That should be the first page for the SJR 202. And then we have a PowerPoint presentation, and then we have a draft measure summary and a draft revenue impact statement. So Senator Morse and I, we're going to go to the
PowerPoint. Okay.
With you.
Thank you. And I want to, while they head to the dais, I want to acknowledge the intensive work that Senator Morse has put in to this product through the interim. It is a very thoughtful piece. I think regardless of where you stand on it, it's a very thoroughly analyzed and thoughtful piece of legislation itself. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Frank Morse. I represent District 8, which is Albany, Lebanon, or excuse me, Lebanon, my hometown, Albany, Corvallis area of the state. Well, here we are again, friends. We're attempting to offer solutions to a problem that seemingly is intractable. I've thought a lot about, you know, this hearing and what might be said, and if you'll indulge me just a moment, colleagues, the best metaphor I can think of was a story that was told 2,000 years ago. It was about a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon the house, but it did not fall because it was built on a rock. But then there was the foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon the house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. Colleagues and friends who are listening, we have a state that's built on shifting sands, and it's called a very unstable revenue system. And everything that we do in this state is affected by this instability. We seemingly have the capacity and certainly the will in this assembly to tackle difficult issues. For example, healthcare transformation, sweeping changes in education. And we have the capacity to change this unstable platform, this unstable foundation upon which our state operates. But do we have the will? That's the fundamental question. Do we have the will to offer solutions that will make Oregon a better place, will make Oregon's government operate better and serve our public better? That's the question. Do we have the will? We have the capacity. SJR 202 takes a volatile revenue and spending system, and it moves it to where the volatility would be reduced approximately 50%. I would refer to you a handout that, I didn't bring my own, but I would refer to you a handout that is a close of session general fund ending balance history. And to me, of all of the data that we have put together, this represents the core issue before us today. One of the core issues is what was the will of the legislature in the history for the last 30 years when we received the final June forecast in May, and how did we treat that forecast? How much money did we reserve left unappropriated as an ending fund balance? And what you'll see is a history, and if you average all of those percentages for this history, we have left unappropriated approximately 1%, which means that we decided that we would spend about 99% of every forecasted dollar. So what we have left is we have no real we have a statutory general purpose saving plan, but what we don't have is the mechanism to feed that plan. Because if history is repeated, which it likely would be, the ending fund balance would be de minimis, and our statutory rainy day fund is filled with that ending fund balance. This proposal moves it to a constitutionally disciplined saving mechanism. Where we have today no general purpose reserves, we would wind up with robust general purpose reserves. And of course, this whole issue that seems to be so problematic in the discussion about our revenue system is the kicker. And what this does, it changes the kicker. It doesn't repeal it. In essence, it does it technically, but it changes the calculation of excess revenue from one that's based on the forecast, and we know the forecast over the long horizon is relatively accurate. They've done a good job. We've seen that information. But what we know is in the short term, it's virtually impossible. Virtually impossible. But yet we base our appropriations and expenditures on the basis of that method, and it just doesn't make sense. So this changes it from a kicker that's based on forecast revenue to a kicker based on actual economic growth. And the other issue that is in the forefront, and it's in the governor's agenda, and I think we support a longer horizon view of the budget. And that's what this would do. You would move from a short-term budgeting and spending perspective to a long-term budgeting and spending projection. So colleagues and friends, when is the right time? When is the right time to address this? Is it today? Is it this session? And if it isn't, then when? And if it isn't this proposal, then what proposal will bring this stability and build a foundation for our state? Those are fundamental questions, and they've been left unaddressed. We've said it's too hard, it's too steep a hill to climb, but our state depends on stability. Our children don't go home because the economy falls. We know that. Our seniors, those that depend on us, their condition hasn't changed. But when we have an unstable platform, we have a house that's built on shifting sands, we need to address it, and we need to make it a priority. And it needs to be a priority in this session. So, Madam Chair, I apologize for... Well, no, I don't apologize. Doggone it, it's time to do something. Paul, could you please explain what this is?
Madam Chair, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and I'll walk through the key elements of SJR 202. The first key element of the concept is it amends the Constitution, and this is important because you recall last session we had a measure in the committee that was a revision because of some of the multiple aspects to it. This, however, was designed as an amendment so that it would not require the two-thirds legislative approval as a revision would. It eliminates the 2% surplus kicker provision in the Constitution, and if you look at the first line in the bill, that's what it does. But it replaces that a new provision, a new excess revenue calculation, which, of course, the kicker is, and the kicker is a revenue limit. So this replaces the revenue limit with another revenue limit. And that revenue limit is based on personal income growth, as Senator Morris said. It establishes this Constitutional General Purpose Reserve Fund in the same section of the Constitution. Once this excess revenue is calculated, if there is excess revenue, it will go into the reserve fund until the cap is reached. And once that cap is reached, then the excess revenue will be returned to taxpayer in a manner determined by law. So the details, the excess revenue calculation is made, and we also have simulations that show all of the calculations that are made, and I would be happy to provide those as well. But we'll see what they look like when in terms of graphically here in a minute. But the excess revenue calculation takes revenue growth over the 6 years immediately preceding the biennium. So, and it's an average growth per two-year period for that six-year period. So you take 3 2-year periods, and you take that average for personal income. Personal income is the broadest measure we have in the U.S. data system for the state economy, the size of the state economy. It would capture inflationary effects. It would capture what we call extensive growth or growth due to population, and it would also incorporate intensive growth, which would be real per capita growth. So all of those components are part of that personal income measure. Now, that excess revenue occurs when revenue growth exceeds that average income growth over the prior 3 years. And the revenue is calculated. You would take, for example, let's say that this measure was in effect at the end of the biennium is when you make this calculation. So you would make this calculation August of 13. So at the end of 11-13 biennium, so August of 13, you would look at the revenue that came in, general fund revenue, 11-13, and then you'd compare that with the legislatively approved appropriations for 09-11. So it would be that percentage change in that period. And then that would be compared with the average growth for the 6 years up through 2012. So you'd have 11, 12, 9, 10, and 7, 8. The growth rate in those 3 years, the average, that would be compared with that revenue growth. Anything above that would be this excess revenue. And then that's what would go into the reserve fund. And you can see the reserve fund elements, they should look familiar because they are the same as the Education Stability Fund. The one exception is it does have the two-thirds limitation on the amount that can be withdrawn in any one biennium, and that is in the statutory Rainy Day Fund, but not in the ESF. The reserve fund is capped at 12% of prior biennium general fund revenue. So that now is about a billion four is what that would be. Calculation of excess revenue. You can see historically what the excess revenue was. I put the negatives in there. The negatives, under the definition of the bill, would not be excess revenue, so you can't have negative excess revenue. But the you'll notice that we go back to the start with the 83-85 biennium. You can see, of course, that we don't have excess revenue coming out of the weak economy of the 80s. It begins to accumulate in the 90s with a strong growth period, and then by the late 90s, we're getting over $1 billion in excess revenue. You can see the impact of the 01-03 recession. The 03-05 was the fallout from that period as well. You have that one biennium that it came back, and we had the large kicker under current law. And then you can see that we have the huge drop in the 09-11 biennium from the Great Recession. One of the things I've done here is I've used the December forecast through 11-13, but I did use a I modified the forecast in 15-17 by simulating recession. In the forecast, we just have kind of trend growth out there. So I put in a recession to see how this would perform, and you can see that we have negative excess revenue at that time, and then we can see what happens in terms of the reserve allocations. But that's how the excess revenue calculation would look historically if SGR 202 had been in place. And, of course, when we calculate revenue, we assume all the revenue that went out as kickers was retained. So that's how I come up with that simulation. This is the allocation of excess revenue between reserve fund deposits. And when the blue line is negative, those would be reserve fund withdrawals. So, of course, you see those in the last 10 years. We have a fair number of them, including $500 million-plus withdrawals in 01-03, 03-05, and again in 09-11. And then in 1517, I'd have one in that simulated recession. Notice that we have in those red bars are the periods in which excess revenue, the reserve fund cap has been reached at 12%, and we have returns to taxpayers in the late 1990s. Remember that we think of this period as kind of a one of a lot of fiscal difficulties, but that was not because of revenue growth. That was largely because of Measure 5 and the impact that Measure 5 had. But in terms of revenue growth, we had growth over 20% in several of those biennium. Here's what the simulation would look like. I've taken actual and projected general fund expenditures. My projected general fund expenditures, I just assume that, the revenue projection is spent. In terms of the, and then the rest of it is historically what happened. For the simulated general fund expenditures, I would include the dollars that could be spent under the new revenue limit. In other words, you wouldn't spend the excess revenue. And then during those periods where the triggers are met, I assume that the legislature would take the full two-thirds of the balance out and deposit those and spend them. So that those reserve fund withdrawals are captured in that red line. And you can see what happens is that you have a lot more stable revenue or expenditure stream. You're spending less in the late 90s, the period of very rapid revenue growth, spending more in the 2000s in the period when things were weak. You'll see in a minute that the 2009-11 period would have been, I don't think you could have come up with a reserve fund that could have isolated the state from that effect given the depth of the recession at that time. Then you can see in the future that what happens is you take some of that expenditure from 13-15, put it in the reserve fund, and then smooth out the later years. Here's what it looks like on a percentage change basis. That's that same chart, only this shows the percentage change from biennium to biennium. The blue line is the actual general fund expenditures. You can see that they're jumping over 20% as revenue growth picks up. The sharp drop in the early 2000s, this is the 02 special sessions when we were hit by the 01 recession. And you can see that is somewhat smoothed out. The one area that you don't see smoothed out, again, is 09-11. And again, that's basically what happened in the simulation is the fund gets drawn down to the point where, because the magnitude of the drop was so great, there wasn't sufficient funds. The lesson there, I think, one clearly is that when you get those kinds of structural shifts like we've had, no reserve fund is going to fully protect you from it. But in terms of normal business cycles, you're able to allocate those funds among those cycles. Here's the measure of volatility, and of course this measure grows out of the work of the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, and you recall that this the standard deviation became the basis of trying to find a way to modify the forecast. But I've used that same simple measure of variability to look at general fund revenue, what it's historically been, and you can see the variability, and you can see why it's so difficult to project. That's 8% is a standard deviation per biennium. So that's a huge variation. Personal income, notice, is not as variable. And that's another reflection of the elasticity or the volatility of our income tax system. The variability of our revenue is much greater than the variability of income. The blue bar shows the actual general fund expenditures, so a little less variability than general fund because the legislature has used other balances and transfers and so forth to try to modify that. And then the purple bar there is that line for simulated general fund expenditures under SJR 202. So if you were to compare the purple bar with the green bar, that's the gain in stability from the SJR 202 simulation versus the actual general fund expenditure simulation. It goes from about 7.3% standard deviation per biennium to about 4.2. So it almost reduces it by about 40%, the volatility as measured by the standard deviation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you for this good work. Okay, we are going to call up a series of panels on this. We'll start out, if we can pull up one more chair, we'll start out with a business panel of Jeff Stone, Jeremy Rogers, J.L. Wilson, and Brian Deckert. Technology to separate the chairs. That's quite liberating.
There's an experienced person dealing with hearing rooms.
Welcome. Who would like to go first? Jeremy, you look
kick
very
it off.
Eager here.
Great. Thank you, Senator Burdick, Senator Morse, and members of the committee. Just for the record, I'm Jeremy Rogers with the Oregon Business Council. We're a statewide business organization that mobilizes business executives to shape public policy in Oregon. We have a long history of working on big, difficult public policy issues, including tax policy and revenue stability issues. We staff the Oregon Business Plan, which we partner with a lot of the other groups here on, and since the inception of that plan in 2002, revenue stability has been a top priority and something that we've discussed extensively at our annual business summit, and that we've worked with you to try to advance through the Education Stability Fund, through partnering with our other business groups to capitalize the first general purpose rainy day fund in 2007, supporting the proposal by Senator Morrison Burdick last year. And we are here again to let you know that we strongly, fundamentally support this measure. We want to work with you, with the partners in business and partners in labor, to figure out how to pass this measure, both in the legislature and also at the ballot. We recognize that there's a political conversation that's going to have to happen with voters that will require research and campaign planning and fundraising and et cetera. And we would like to, you know, work with partners on that. OBC and other business groups have been involved with conversations with labor and the governor recently around revenue reform, and I believe that there is the will among the advocacy groups to come together and get this done. From a policy perspective, I think this is a very good approach, probably the best approach that we've seen to stability, with a 40% reduction in volatility. I was doing some homework last night. Pew did a study a few years ago, showed that the revenue drop Oregon had between Q1 2008 and Q1 2009 was the third highest in the country, yet we don't have a permanent mechanism to fill the reserve fund. And, that's going to keep happening, and we want to do what we can to stop it. I do want to challenge the assumption that folks, you know, the Oregon Business Council and I think other groups do not want this bad enough. We do want it bad enough, and we'll do what we can to make it happen. Thank you for your continued leadership on this. We know it's difficult, and we Oregon should thank all of you for continuing to push this forward. Thanks.
Thank you. J.L.?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. We support and endorse SJR 202. Our feeling is, frankly, it's just time to do this, and we think 202 is the vehicle. Not only is it the most more rational approach to public finance that currently exists today, but it's the most rational reform proposal we've seen to date. You wouldn't believe the expressions on our board when I actually explained this in 15 seconds, and that's all it took. They didn't even have time to check Blackberries or anything like that. So, and that to me is invaluable, because that means we can explain it to voters, and if we can explain it to our membership like that. And we're committed to helping this pass, both in the legislature and the ballot box, like I mentioned before. It's just time to do this. So we support the measure, and let's get on with it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ryan Decker, president of the Oregon Business Association. So I'm going to depart from script a bit. JL said it took him 15 seconds to present this to his board. It took me about 10 minutes on Wednesday night to walk our board through the proposal. The one thing that after we took a vote and endorsed the proposal that I walked away with is at some point we have to pull the trigger. So we have, who was it, Will Rogers, who said, everyone talks about the weather and no one does anything about it. I think it was Will Rogers. So we've been talking about stability packages. I can get back two decades. So I can go back two decades that we've gathered in this room, and we could gather in other rooms. We always have one eye on the election process, which is a necessity on this one. But we could go back a couple decades where we, and you can get similar testimony, and you could go back into your archives and find similar testimony. And so at some point, we are going to have to pull the trigger and just ask the question of Oregon voters. And the one observation that I have, just having watched this, is nature abhors a vacuum. And so the one thing I've found is you got to get a train going. Now, Senator Morse, this is a pretty fast locomotive, challenging a lot of folks to figure it out and jump on or off or get in the caboose or the driver's seat. But at some point, and the only hope I have is if we can't get it done in February, we have had some good discussions with the governor, with legislative leadership about how do you get to this coming election cycle, because you have options available to you. And I actually think this committee, as you look around, who's the right body to actually look through, comb through, perfect proposals, it should be here. It should be done legislatively. This is a committee that's worked on this issue, and the membership has for a long time. And that provides a great opportunity to perfect something and actually try to drive that train towards a close ballot, because fortunately or unfortunately, they just come around every couple years, and presidential elections, which are big turnout elections, only come around every 4 years. And so I think that would be our testimony, is that at some point, it'll never be the perfect moment. The polling is not great, at least that we've seen. It's not fantastic. It's not terrible either. But at some point, we just have to ask the question and see who's on board. And if we take a loss, at least we knew when we all went down trying to get something done. Thank you.
Morning, Madam Chair. Jeff Stone, Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We stand here before you this morning in support of this endeavor. I think the very basic tenets set forth put us towards a path of stability. You heard in great detail Senator Morris and Paul's explanation of the bill, so we delineate a little bit on why we think certain aspects are important in our written testimony to you. We also know that this is not an easy task. I think it's the right path. I think getting the voters of Oregon involved is absolutely the right call. I think taking the measures, the steps that you have to try to provide and avoid the feast and famine of budgeting that we perpetually go through. Now, just because we don't have the nursery and greenhouse industry, really thinks that this type of step forward boldness needs to happen. And I'll conclude my testimony by saying over the last year, we've had both you, Senator Burdick, and you, Senator Morris, talk to our members. And at that time, you talked about the very tenets of, the building blocks of this particular proposal. At that time, our members are 100% behind you about asking the big question. So I encourage you to pass this bill. I encourage us to try to get this bill passed now. I agree with your earlier statement, Senator Morse, about if not now, when? So let's have the conversation. I'm pleased that of my fellow business folks up here, they're great leaders, and we'll all be in this boat together. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Harrison.
Well, I very much appreciate all of your testimony, and I guess it's more of a comment. First, as kind of a reminder, to your question, do we have the will, Senator Morris? There was a ticker vote last session, and four people voted for it. It was this panel, and it didn't go much further than that, but I think at least in this room we have the will. The missing ingredient here seems to be, even if you have the data and the computer modeling and have the perfect bill, which I think we can do easily. We have the capacity, as you noted, we can do transformation, education reform. To get people from here to there takes something more than data. It mm-hmm. takes inspiration, motivation, and that's the missing point. This is even as simple as this bill, it's rather complex to people who don't follow this issue. And it's so much easier to shoot this thing down than it is to build it up. That's one of the struggles with leadership, really. And that I think, is the holy grail on this issue, is to inspire people that we can do our best if we pass this and not listen to those voices who would take one part of it or just be cynical about it. And I keep searching for whatever that is here, and it's a Zen-like approach that you almost have to take to get there. And I don't think we have that secret sauce yet, and I wish we do, and I'm searching for it, and I'd like to do this as soon as possible, but that seems to be the thing that we need to hunt down.
Any of you have comments on that?
It's a Zen-like question. The way in is the way out.
Well, thank you. Chair Burdick and Senator Haas, I would just ask you to observe what's happened to date. I mean, you've got business rallying around this issue to the extent you've never seen before. Our members are fully bought and engaged. I believe there will be others following us on the other side of the spectrum that feels similarly. You've got the drumbeat. One of our newspapers in the state, the Oregonian, is beating the drum on this issue. You've got a critical mass forming, and I don't know, something we haven't seen before, where all the parties seem to be coming together. And so I would submit to you, I think that is taking place, because there are a lot of things falling in place now that we just haven't seen before.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, one, the chair of our board right now is Nike, and so the just do it idea at some point, I actually think on this issue, we're just going to have to do it and just ask the question, see who goes, who doesn't go. I really do think that we're just going to have, we've pulled this thing, we've focus grouped it, we know who's, I just think at some point we just got to pull the trigger and go. And I think this election cycle, there's that opportunity. And you can always call yourself back in if you need a month off or 2 months off. You could do, we've seen this body do that in a day, move one proposal from this committee to the floor, to a House committee to the floor. So I'm in some ways hopeful that this could trigger that.
From a practical standpoint, and we've all been through campaigns, that's what Oregon is a lot of campaigns. Can you visualize a multi-million-dollar, completely engaged campaign, which is what it would take to get this, passed? Can you envision that getting up and running by November of 2014?
2014 or 2012?
I'm sorry, 2012. Oh.
I thought I misread the bill.
I'm a future thinker.
Well, I'll allow, Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, I'll allow my good friends here to countermand me. But I think I'm very interested to see how others approach this issue following this particular panel. I think if you can get a critical mass of folks who want to problem solve, I think you can put together a winning combination of folks to make that a successful endeavor. For the nursery and greenhouse industry, this is the worst economic plight we've ever seen. And so, but is this something that we would go to our members and say, this is of a critical importance to our state? We absolutely would. And so I think it's going to take more than just the business community to pass this. And then frankly, if we don't have more than just the business community, then let's take the time to do this so we can get more people on board. That's my comment about that.
Anybody else? Okay, thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Okay, our next panel will be Lori Wimmer, Ralph Groner, and Bill Clute.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here today to testify in favor of this SJR. We believe that it inventively revises the way the Oregon kicker is calculated, constitutionalizes the general purpose rainy day fund, and also helps to ensure general fund stability for the long term. Our association has long supported plans to develop adequate reserves to hedge against economic downturns and also to protect vital services during the business cycles. We've had to cope in the lean years with tremendous losses, as I'm sure you know, in education. And rising fluctuations have been hard on not only our system and its workers, but most especially for the students in our schools and community colleges and higher ed. We thank Senators Burdick and Morse for crafting the proposal that would, if the voters do approve it, minimize such economic traumas in the future. We also think it makes sense to call to base these so-called excess revenues. Please forgive me. I don't believe they're excess. I think the way we calculate the kicker, it's they should be called unanticipated revenues, but that's just me. But I do believe that there's a better way to have that conversation with voters about what constitutes an excess, if you will, and what to do with it. And by riding the tide of our citizens' actual prosperity rather than some mathematical miscalculation, we believe that makes a lot of sense, just like we do with our statutory spending cap, which is also aligned with personal income growth. We also appreciate that the proposal is structured to avoid the ratcheting effect that immortalizes cuts in the bad times and also blocks recovery in good times. For all these reasons, we are confident that this proposal is sound. In fact, it's the best I've ever seen. Our only concern today is one of timing. It's our belief that a proposal of this scale merits a longer conversation with Oregon voters before it's put to its ultimate test at the ballot. This good plan deserves the time it takes to make its way around the state before we ask voters to approve it. And we know this because we've been working on ballot measures for many years, and anything with the complexity that this proposal has to it just tends to lead to voter confusion and mistrust if not explained to them. And that's a grassroots education effort, to be honest with you. Nevertheless, we look forward to partnering with you and working on that particular project in the future, and to support sustainable state finance and revenue planning. And we look forward to seeing this on a future ballot, but perhaps not 2012. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing Oregon AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We're here to support the measure. I would like to correct an Oregonian article that said Labor hadn't supported this last session, when in fact I was called up by the committee first and supported the measure. They politically added capital gains to it, which I thought was a bit of a political mistake, and said if you'd lower it to the governor's capital gains. But we supported the measure last session, and we do today, and I want to thank you for hearing this and working so diligently on the kicker, Senator Morse and Senator Burdick and the rest of you. I look at things a little different, and so let me do this. When you add groups to your list politically, here's the part I would probably be involved in, not only my union. I work on a number of issues, some here don't. So let me list how they're hurt by not having a kicker and bringing it to their attention, which we haven't done. I work very specifically as a person who works in the social service arena with seniors and people with disabilities. My members in Multnomah and throughout Oregon are the folks in every county I look at here are the ones who are the case managers, are the people who deal with seniors and people with disabilities. And quite frankly, because of the vicissitudes of this budget over the years, we never know what that caseload is going to be. Seniors end up, rather than with the in-home care, which, by the way, is $800 a month, like other states, it's 10 times higher today in a nursing home at over $8,000. So I'm one who cares very much about reducing your cost by preventive programs. It's an impossibility to do without a sound program to help have a budget that has, like I have to have in my checking at my home, to make sure I have some backup reserves to cover these kind of crises. Not only is it a typical crisis, but it's the kind that can save you, the taxpayers, money in this general fund if we had a reserve fund to help cover some of those losses. In public safety, your second, I cover DNA, state police. So an example, you've read the Oregonian, so I'll just comment on it. If we can't keep up with our DNA work because of lack of budgeting here, the fact is we have people who go without being punished. We simply can't keep up with the kind of staffing we need to make sure that, I hate to use this language, but murderers, rapists, they get first attention. Don't get me wrong. However, people who happen to broke into your home, that's just one down the road, and that person who had their home broke in cares. We don't have a reserve fund when they needed staffing back up to count that budget. The fact is it then costs the taxpayer more money to meet with the demands of those people who have been violated by criminals. And the third one, education. I do not represent K-12, but I do represent MESDs and ESDs, but education in general. When I listened yesterday to the state representative co-chair in front of revenue, House Revenue, the fact is I was shocked that Oregon is now 43rd, according to him, in funding of higher ed. Well, I'm very proud of Intel. They're my heroes because they hire over, I forgot the number Paul gave me, 15,000 employees with an average salary of $125,000 a year. Guess who's funding my members' jobs? Mm-hmm. These folks are. And if we're going to have the Intels of the future or add on to the future, we not only need other issues you've covered, but we can't help them if we don't have backup funds. I call this a prevention program that will help the public and seniors, public safety, education. My granddaughter I raise, she's 16 now. She doesn't go to school half the time anymore that we would have gone. Her classes are so overcrowded. We're in a very large Oregon City school district, but you have the same problem in your district. I can't see how she's getting the education that I did with 11 kids in my class at West Lynn Sunset Grade School through 8 grades, and a high school that had about 80 kids in my high school class. Not that I learned anything, but some did. So I would like to close with the thought that, yes, you will hear the typical things, but the truth is if you don't have a reserve program that makes some sense, which this one does, then the fact of the matter, it's beyond just business, labor. It really is counterproductive economically in a variety of ways in the three areas we fund. Human services, I gave you an example. Public safety, I gave you an example. And education. So thank you for this opportunity, and we're on board. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Laura, you mentioned timing issue. And if you were queen of the universe with all your campaign experience in your organization, how would you go about that?
Madam Chair, I think the most important thing to do is to not only follow the cue of where the voters are now, but to help them understand a proposal in such a way that you plow the ground so that they can be embracing of the proposal rather than just putting it on the ballot. If that education piece happens, however long it takes, I'm not certain what that is. I can't crystal ball gaze. But we would pledge that that would be a priority for us. It has been for many years. We just need to make sure that what we have, because these are very, very expensive campaigns, we have to make sure that that those dollars that we spend on a yes vote would be a good investment as well, that they would actually yield what you're all looking for. I don't want to put something out prematurely only to fail, because that would be pretty heartbreaking.
Other questions? Thank you. Okay. Next panel, Carolyn Marnick, Cappy Eaton, and Tricia Yates. You can come on. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Who wants to go first?
Thanks.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. You have received our written testimony, so I'm going to be very brief. SCR 202 offers a unique opportunity to help solve Oregon's historical economic cycles. It is straightforward, rational, and based on income growth, not economic forecasts and percentages. It preserves the ability to return excess revenues to taxpayers when there are adequate reserves to protect critical state services and programs. It allows a legislature to determine when and how to use the reserves. It is time to allow Oregonians to discuss and decide how to move the state forward and out of the shadows of economic cycles and their impact on our lives. The League knows something about voter education, and we would fully participate and partner in the discussion that we should have on this important issue. The League urges you to give the opportunity for public debate with the passage of SCR 202. Some of us are running out of time to do this, so just do it.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Caroline Marnock, and I'm a parent of two boys at Lincoln High School in Portland and a member of Stand for Children. And although this resolution doesn't deal with the adequacy of school funding, it is a step in the right direction to provide stable funding. And I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about the need and hopefully provide that motivation that Senator Hass asked about earlier this morning. So school budgets, as you know, are a constant flux, and they have just been eviscerated these past years. Our family really felt the effects this past September when we learned that our two boys wouldn't start school until 10 a.m. on some days and would be out as early as 1:20 in the afternoon on other days. And both of them are taking a regular full load of 6 or 7 classes. They are in school just over 5 hours in a day, which is, in effect, part-time high school. This all came about last year when the district and board faced huge losses in funding. They decided to cut over 3 weeks of class time in the high schools. But instead of lopping off days and risking another unflattering depiction in a Doonesbury comic strip, they simply shortened the amount of instruction time during the day. So this makes it that much harder for the students to be taught the material they need to learn in order to pass the state tests and graduate. It also makes it difficult for the teachers to cover the material needed for kids to do well on our IB and our AP tests. For example, the International Baccalaureate IB courses are supposed to have 150 hours of class time. But our students are taking the test this year after only 117 hours. I don't know how it's possible for them to really learn the material they do need to pass these tests. So many high school kids who don't have those early release times or late start times like my boys, they have gaps in the middle of the day in their schedules. So to handle this, some of the high schools have put 50 to 100 students in massive study halls like Grant High School, where there is no teacher. There's just a class monitor. So this raises a real safety concern that parents and teachers and administrators have been talking about. There's so few adults in the schools now because of the slashes in the support staff and the teachers that there's no one there to monitor the campuses. So locker rooms are often not supervised. And there are areas where kids and others who aren't even students can just hide and come into the school unnoticed. You know, I feel that we shouldn't have to wait for some catastrophic event to happen before adults in these rooms finally are motivated to do something and fix this problem. So frankly, it really defies common sense that when our schools don't have enough money to provide and teach our students a full day or a full calendar year, like other parts of the country do, that our state government incredulously is forced to give away money in the kicker. So we urge you to continue working on solutions like this resolution. And while Stan would like to further analyze the fiscal implications, I can tell you that we do tentatively support this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Burdick and members. I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association, representing the 1,400 volunteer elected directors in our school districts, ESDs, and community colleges. It's my pleasure this morning to be here in support of SGR 202. It's the priority of our directors to support increased student achievement in our schools. And in order to do that, they also have the priority of having stable and adequate funding. And as we've mentioned, we are here to talk about adequate funding as well. We acknowledge the governor's statement that education in our state is underfunded at all levels, and we're committed to working with you to change that situation. But in the meantime, this proposal takes us in a step in the right direction for adequacy. It addresses the unstable funding, the cycle of boom and bust that our directors face that makes it so difficult in managing their budgets to support student achievement. Senator Morris was correct when he said that our children don't go home because the economy fails. They're in our schools looking for our support and looking for that stability and adequacy that it takes. We like the approach that SGR 202 takes in stabilizing general fund resources over the long term, especially for our schools. Excuse me. And it makes great sense to calculate the excess revenue based on actual economic growth. That just seems to be great common sense. So we're here to say thank you for this measure. Thank you for your leadership in bringing us here. And we're supportive of SGR 202.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Keep up the good work, you guys. All right. Thank you very much. Our last panel that signed up anyway is Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly. Is Bill Cluding here? Do you want to testify? You missed the last panel. Come on up.
Jody Weiser, for the record. I think it's great that this particular panel includes citizen groups and a union. I think that's exactly, you know, that's exactly the face we need to put forward on this bill. So I represent Tax Fairness Oregon, and when Lori was mentioning the number of her constituents, basically, we have 2,500 participants in Tax Fairness Oregon. And we support this bill. The numbers show satisfyingly good morsels of revenue that will be saved, but the kicker alone can't fully fund the kind of rainy day savings we all know we need. At least historically, kickers haven't generated enough dollars for the savings that we would wish to create between recessions. But SJR 202 is a step in the right direction. The mechanism at least appears to smooth the revenue stream enough to remove some of the volatility without sacrificing the opportunity for some recovery. We want to thank the sponsors for their persistence on this issue year after year after year for bringing forward finally a really viable solution. With bipartisan support and the elements in this bill that include both savings and the continued kicker possibility, we think it will be appealing to citizens. It's been a number of years now since they've had a kicker, and that should help. With legislators of both parties voting for it, it should not become a campaign issue that will affect the Democratic-Republican count in the legislature, and that should help. With the business community support the sponsors have brought to the legislation, it should avoid the labor-business split, and that should help. Since it can be put forward both as a savings fix rather than a kicker killer, it has a good chance of being well-viewed. That should help. It will take energy, skill, volunteers, and money. And we should have some sessions together and include the press, because they agree with us, on how to go about talking about this. J.R. Wilson might be the right person to teach us how.
15 seconds.
Yeah. Either that or he has an extraordinarily smart board.
Or, no, I think he must have some good keys. And there are definitely people at the national level from both sides of the aisle that know a lot about framing. And we should bring them in and we should get everybody talking in the same way. And then we should remain calm and certain. Because really all we're doing is fixing a little mistake. We're not killing anything, and we're not solving all the problems of our budget. So I don't think it should be that difficult to pass, and I think we should move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia?
Thank you, Madam Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Morris, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council, and we are here in support of SJR 202. Senator Morris made about the best point you can make. Shifting sands and strong foundation. You know, Oregon once had a strong foundation. You take a pyramid, how it's built. The industrial sector took up almost the bottom half of that pyramid. The pyramid's upside down now. Oregon has lost its industrial sector. Every day I ask myself, we have one of the world's greatest renewable natural resources in this state. 90% of it we can't even touch. This pin, ironically, people are wearing, it's not quite what our mill industry, our timber mills lost since 1985, 56,000 direct mill jobs. Now, that's not counting aluminum plants, steel plants. We can't even keep food processors in this state. On top of that, one of the most modern paper plants in this United States. And Senator Morris knows exactly where I'm going with this. He's making paper in China today. This is a good bill. I agree with the concept. I wish I could see the excess revenue coming in. I can't. Your hardest job ahead of you today is bringing the industrial sector back to Oregon. We got to keep our public sector. In fact, we don't have enough. We all know where the problems are. And on behalf of Lee Hazelwood, if he was here today, he wore himself out this week. If he was here today, he'd voice approval of this. And you know, he's Project Independence is what he comes in here for, on his own. 90 years old. Please, let's put the industrial sector back to work in this state. Thank you.
Marcia?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, and other members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. Fair and equitable taxation has long been a public policy platform, and we maintain it in our legislative priorities for every session. Kicker reform is necessary, and I signed up as neutral because I have some concerns about one section of the kicker reform that you put forward, and that's the 12% limitation on the fund. I'd be much more comfortable with 15%, which might smooth out that area where Paul showed that we still would be about half a billion down in the way that this is structured. If we're going to get to the 40-40-20 that the legislature adopted last session, if we're going to have more kids eating school lunch, not because they're bringing their lunch to school, but because so many schools are on four-day school weeks and 15 to 20 furlough days, we need a little bit more in the reserve fund. So that's the hesitation that I have on the kicker. We need to also not think that this is the last thing we need to do for tax reform. When we passed ballot measure 40, ballot measure 5 in 1990 and flipped the way we funded education, we flipped every other service in the state as well. Seniors in this state who need public transportation, part of the money is provided by the lawnmower fund. It's the calculation of the gasoline taxes that people pay when they go to the gas station, fill up a can, and then put that gas in the lawnmower. Other public transportation is not funded adequately. And as we have a tsunami of my generation, born in 1948, soon to be next week 64 years old, we're going to need more public transportation, and we don't have an adequate way of funding that. And in addition, the other thing we need to look at on tax reform is commendably the effort that you made last session in tax expenditures, but continuing to look at that, because that would smooth out the dips when we have economies that go south. And we do have economies that go south. We can have other things that happen in Oregon that might need more money. An earthquake hitting the I-5 corridor. Very possible. Very real. So I would be wholeheartedly out there supporting this for the American Association of University Women if that percentage was higher. We'll still support it, but I'm going to have still heart palpitations about what we do to our spending for other things if everybody thinks that kicker reform is the only part of tax reform we need. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Senator Morris?
Do we have more people to testify?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to make the heartfelt appreciation for the time to evaluate and to testify for all of those, you know, the various sectors of our society. I mean, it is very gratifying to see that happen. My question is, I mean, we've come to a unique point in time that I've not seen in my history here, where there's a genuine interest to develop a coalition to move this forward. And my question is, if you don't have a specific vehicle to rally around, how do you develop the coalitions? How do you develop the education? How do you develop the strategies to move this to success? We have to have a vehicle. You know, you can get a thumb ride home to Portland. You might eventually get there, but it has a you're a whole lot better if you have a car to drive.
Or a train to ride.
And to take this energy and this interest and let it languish is just not acceptable. And I don't know how you can build the coalitions without having the vehicle. And so I think that's our challenge, and the challenge for everyone that has an interest in this bill and in making Oregon a better place is to move it to where it actually becomes a vehicle. And that's our immediate challenge. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Yes, Jody.
Jody Weiser, for the record. I'd like to suggest that in the first week of March, we have a gathering of people who want to work on it.
The discussions around that point, because Senator Morse raises a really good point on how do you arrange things. If you need more time, what's the best way to arrange things so that you do have a focal point, something that people can hang their hat on? We will be having, this is a very short session, but we will be having intensive conversations on that point because it's a very valid point. Is there anybody else who didn't testify and would like to? Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 202. And if there's, we didn't leave anything out.
No, we're carrying on 1530.
Okay, and We will reconvene on Monday at our new time of 8:30. We are adjourned. We are adjourned. Time of 8:30.